The intent in this series really is to look kind of hard at the sciences that we're interested in, the mind-brain sciences, and to reflect on some of the really deep things that we do not understand about how the brain is organized and how it works. We all have a tendency, of course, to get very excited when there are new results and to think that really the fundamental framework for understanding mind-brain function has emerged.
But if we're really honest with ourselves and we think about the number of fundamental questions to which we don't have answers, it's a very sobering thought. Now, it's a very special thing then to have Chuck Stevens here today from the Salk Institute to talk to us about some of the research that he is pursuing. And as you know, the title of his talk concerns the scalable architecture of nervous systems. How is that possible, and why does the brain care? Now, many of you who spend most of your time on this campus may not know Chuck so well, and so I want to say a few things about him just to sort of give it a bit of a setting. I first encountered Chuck's work through a book that many of us, I think, clutched to ourselves very closely. It was a book he wrote in 1966 called Neurophysiology, A Primer. And by God, for those days, it really was a primer. And the amazing thing about this book was that it was 184 pages, including bibliography. Now, of course, now it would be considered rather bizarre to write a book that was that short, but it really did kind of define the field as it was then and sort of set the agenda for some years to come. More recently, one of the things that the Stevens lab worked on was the synapse. Now, some of you may not realize that in the early stages of neuroscience, there was a big discussion about whether you really needed to know very much about neurons at all. Why not just know about networks and let neurons do whatever it is that they do? But of course, the field was really transformed as people began to understand the nature of the neuron and how complex it was. And then it was perceived as being absolutely critical that you understand this thing, the synapse. Now, when I learned my neuroscience, one of the things that was perhaps not told to us so much as just a background assumption goes like this, and you'll all be familiar with this. So, when you have an axon and the spike comes down the axon, when it hits the axon terminal, there is release of neurotransmitter and the signal gets transferred to the next neurons. And we assumed that it happened every time a spike went down the axon. And an extraordinary discovery made only sort of under heroic technical conditions was made in the Stevens lab, which is this. It turns out that only with a degree of probability when a spike comes down is there transmitter release. And when you think about it, and I was sort of stunned when I first learned this and drove home, practically drove off the road thinking, what does this mean for how we think about cell-to-cell communication? Now, it turns out that probability of release can go up and down as a function of the interactivity between the neurons. So you can increase the probability of release or decrease it. And it's a very, very fast form of memory without having to go through structural changes, gene expression, and the whole kit and caboodle. But it did, at this very fundamental level, I think, give us a very different way of thinking about synaptic connectivity and what really neurons are doing when, as we blithely say, they communicate with each other. So that gives you kind of a feel for the really sort of paradigm-shifting, cutting-edge research that has typified the work of Chuck Stevens throughout his career. So I think that the cameras are set up, and may I just invite you again, as always, to be as obstreperous and outspoken and all that, And do please interrupt when you don't understand, because it almost certainly means there are other people also who don't understand. So I'm going to shift the mic over now to Chuck and let you take it away.
Great. Thank you, Pat. And let me emphasize that this is not a lecture that is so beautifully prepared that I will be upset if you stop me and ask me questions. You can be obstreperous and you can even be rude. That would be okay, too. Okay, so I'm just going to sit down. The picture that you see behind the funny-looking man is a homunculus. And what that is intended to show is how much of the cortex is taken up by different parts of the body. So in the somatosensory cortex, for example, this is almost the only color slide. So if you can see it at all, just let it be. Okay, this is the motor cortex and the sensory cortex. Here's the cortical surface around here, and this little homunculus up here is representing how much of the cortex is there to represent each part of the body. And the reason that the hand and the lips are so large, and say the back is just almost not there, is because we have very fine discrimination with fingers, with lips, and very poor discrimination with the two-point discrimination for the back is you can't tell things any closer apart than that. So the idea is that you devote more of the brain to things that you need to do more precisely, and so the entire motor cortex is parceled up according to how much processing you have to do for each part. This is the star-nosed mole, and here's the mole, and this is his nose, and it has 11 tentacles sticking out. You can see them out there. And this is a mole homunculus, a star mole homunculus. And what you'll see is that 20% of the cortex is for the body, 20% is for the hands with the claws. These guys live underground in tunnels, and they use their nose and these little tentacles on their nose, the little fingers, they use them for feeling, finding food, which they do incredibly effectively and very rapidly. And you can see that half of the cortical area of the somatosensory system is devoted to the mole's nose. And this is just an example of how, where you need to have a lot of computations done on something. Here's a picture of the mole. There's his nose. This is what the nose looks like with 11 little fingers on each side. And here is the somatosensory region. And if you take this and put it down here, this half of it is all devoted to the mole's nose. Now this seems to you something not at all strange. Everyone has known about homunculuses, and people are not surprised to see that a mole has a big part of its cortex devoted to the nose. But you know, there is actually a very deep insight about the way the nervous system works, is designed, that comes from this. If you look at the somatosensory cortex, except for rodent hair barrels, the cortex looks all the same. You can't tell that any part of the somatosensory cortex is different from any other part. And what this is saying is that if you want to use a lot, if you want to have a lot of computational power, what you do is you just have a big region of the cortex. But it probably is the same circuits that are being used for analyzing sensation in other parts of the body. As far as we know, the underlying circuits that are doing the computations for the mole, for interpreting sensation on the mole's back and on the mole's nose, it's the same design. It's the same neural circuit. It's just that if you want to have a lot of computational power, you make it big. So, inside this room, if I got your brains after you died, or I did functional imaging on them, what we would find out is that there is an enormous range in sizes for your V1, your primary visual cortex. This is a graph of the volume of the LGN. The lateral geniculate is the way station between the eye and the primary visual cortex. And this is the volume of the primary visual cortex. And these are a bunch of primates. And there is they're from fairly small primates up to big ones. And up underneath here is chimpanzee, our closest relative. And all of these squares here are people. This is work from Dale Purvis's lab. And what they did is they measured the size of the primary visual cortex in a lot of different people. And they found that within this room, the size of your visual cortex will, the people in this room, their cortex will vary by between 2 and 3-fold. This is not just the thing is bigger, it has more neurons. The visual cortex, some of you have a visual cortex that have a half or a third of the number of neurons than other ones do. Everyone believes your visual cortex works exactly the same way. We all work the same way. In fact, within this room, there are going to be people who have an asymmetric brain, and one of their visual cortexes will be half again as big as the other one. Some people are quite symmetric, some people are asymmetric. And none of you believe that the circuits that are doing your computations for your left side and your right side of your visual cortex are going to be different. There are psychophysical data from Jeff Boynton's lab, where they did vernier acuity and acuity for gratings, and showed that if you have a bigger region of the cortex devoted to a part of the visual world, that you have better vision there, and that's because. That's because you increase the computational power for one part of the cortex or another. Now, this is a speculation. This is an experiment I've always wanted to get someone to do, and I'm willing to bet money on how it's going to come out. There are these guys hitting baseballs that are coming at them at 100 miles an hour. They have to make a decision in a small fraction of a second to extrapolate where the ball is going, and they have to be able to start their swing, meet the ball, and hit it a long ways to get a good job. I'm betting that those guys are the ones that have a big visual cortex. Usually in the visual system, across species, when the primary visual cortex is bigger smaller in this animal compared to that, all the other cortical areas are in proportion. So if area V5 MT is a half as big as V1 in one species, it's going to be half as big in another species. No one has ever done this. You could do it now with functional imaging, but you could measure the size of visual cortex in baseball players, and MT, which is for motion, for extrapolating where the ball is going to go. And I'm betting anything that you'll find that their visual cortex is bigger than mine. In this room, there are people who have a visual cortex that is smaller than the visual cortex of an average chimpanzee. So some of you are down here, and the chimpanzee's right there. That maybe isn't so bad, because the coefficient of variation of the entire brain is much smaller than the coefficient of variation for the visual cortex. The brain doesn't change that much. It does change with size. The people in the room who are bigger have a bigger brain than the people who are smaller. But that's an understood, in a way, it's an understood phenomenon across all species, that there's a very wide, as you get bigger, you have a bigger brain. But the size of the brain between humans doesn't vary nearly as much as the size of the visual cortex does. What that means is that if you're a baseball player and you're extremely good at extrapolating where the ball is going to go, there's going to be something else you're not as good at, because there's going to be some other part of the brain that is smaller. And so on average, people will have more of their computing power put in some places and others than other places. So this is a speculation, but probably the difference between those of us who are extremely good at cooking, and people who are extremely good at doing experiments, and people who are extremely athletic, and people who are extremely musical. The basis for those probably, there's no evidence for this, but they probably have to do with individual variation, at least a lot of this, in the size of the cortical areas that are subserving these functions. Yes?
Yeah, so.
Thank you.
Following that,
how
much variation is there in the total cortex area that you can apportion to different tasks?
Yeah, so that, I can't remember the numbers now, but the coefficient of variation for the entire cortex is like a third of what it is for any one cortical area. So if you have something bigger, something else is going to be smaller, and vice versa. Yes?
You're suggesting a trade-off between different abilities, like the baseball player vision versus other abilities, but doesn't psychological testing suggest that most intelligences, however you measure them, are all positively correlated?
No, they're not all correlated. I mean, there are special abilities that people have. And in general, this is off the subject, and I'm not really an expert in this, but in general, IQ is measured by IQ tests, generally correlates with the size of the frontal cortex. But I don't think there's any much correlation between, say, musical ability and general intelligence. I think those are kind of special abilities. Those of you who are experimentalists will know, this is something that, a personal story. When I was in graduate school, I was doing a very hard experiment, and I had to work about 12 to 14 hours per day, 7 days a week, to get one really good experiment a week. I had a friend who was doing essentially the same experiment, and he got two good experiments a week. And I would ask him, why is this? And he'd give me answers, but we were doing the same experiment. I knew his answers weren't right. They were just superstitions. And this puzzled me and puzzled me and puzzled me. I could not understand why Rick was getting twice as many good experiments as I was. And then I got my own laboratory, and I started seeing people coming through. And there is an enormous difference in how good people are at doing experiments. It's not manual dexterity. It's a special kind of intelligence. And I suddenly realized after about three or four people that came to my lab, oh, I understand Rick is just better than I was. he's got whatever that special intelligence is. He's got more of it than I have. And if you see, those of you who have to do with the experiments, you'll all know that some people are just magical in the laboratory and they get everything to work. It's like being wonderful cooks. Not everybody can be a wonderful cook. And being a wonderful cook depends on being able to notice small things, to extract correlations between whether you put in a little bit of more salt or a little bit more cumin or something like that in your sauce, and to extract from all these variables that are changing what really matters. And it also depends on having good sensation and so forth. So there are these special intelligences that people have. And my thesis is that they probably, I'm not talking about that today, I'm just using this as kind of motivation. But the idea is they probably are something that relates to differences in brain size. That's a testable hypothesis, Jeff.
Yeah. Jeff,
do you think there's a developmental prerequisite to some of this brain plasticity in terms of size? One example is Michael Jordan, probably the greatest basketball player that ever played, wasn't able to become a good baseball player because he didn't play baseball as a kid, but he grew up playing basketball. I mean, is there some wiring that's dependent on the...
Well, yeah, for sure. So, for example, we can all learn to speak any language accent-free if we start before puberty. There are hardly anybody in the world that can learn to speak, if they only know one language, they can learn to speak a second language accent-free after they're 15 or 16 years old. And so there is these critical periods where you have special rewiring of the brain depending on activity dependence, and then that will and the same is true. I mean Tiger Woods started playing golf just up the street here now. He started playing golf when he was when he was like 4 years, 5 years old, something like that. And so there's nobody I think there's nobody who is a concert pianist who started when they were 10 or 12. It's just too late. And so it's not just how big the brain is. But what I'm claiming is that if you took 100 kids and you said, I'm going to make every one of you a concert pianist, and you started them all when they were four, and you made them practice and all that stuff, some of them wouldn't be good enough. They just aren't. And that's what I'm saying would be the difference in the brains.
Okay.
Yeah.
It occurs to me it might be that Michael Jordan had the parietal facial areas much larger, because in basketball you have to have
sure.
in 3D of where you are at all times. So
sure.
And when it came to D1, he came to 100 miles.
That probably is not going to be. And he's quite amazing. I've seen him, pass behind his back when he knew exactly where everybody is on the court, and he would be rushing down the court and then pass behind his back to the guy, catch everybody completely by surprise. And he didn't do it wrong. He did it right every time. So he was planning, I'm sure. But but just to be able to do it, it's pretty. Do it so accurately when everything is moving so fast. But it's a good point. His point is that he doesn't have to hit 100 mile an hour balls. He has other special things. Okay. So this is a diversion on theory in neurobiology. And the reason is that I'm going to be representing today a kind of theory in neurobiology, in all of biology for that matter, that most of you don't think of as a valid kind of theory. So there are three types of theory in neurobiology, and if I were to ask you, tell me what you think of when you think about theory in neurobiology, what most of you would think of is modeling. And these can be computer models, they can be mathematical models, they can sometimes be circuit models. But what you do is you create something in mathematics or in a computer that does what the thing you're trying to model does. And then when you can do that, you say, now I understand the system. And that's what most of you would think of. And in fact, I've talked to people who use theory and modeling as synonymous. There's a second kind of theory in neurobiology, which is tools. So, for example, one of the things that a lot of people do these days is they record simultaneously from a lot of neurons, and you have a lot of spike trains coming at the same time, and they're recording the same electrodes recording two neurons at once, and you have to do spike sorting. So there's going to be another kind of, somebody has to figure out a way of reliably sorting those spikes, and they make computer programs to do this. There are lots of computer programs that recognize genome sequences to find out where the promoters are or where splice sites are and things like that. And so there are a lot of analytic tools that people use, and a lot of these are very sophisticated mathematical techniques or computer techniques. And that's a legitimate area. What I'm going to talk about today is a third area, which is physics-style theory. And that's not I would welcome suggestions for another. I'll explain what I mean by it, but I would welcome suggestions for a better name. A lot of times in physics, what you do is you take something you know has to be true about the system. You know that something has to be conserved, there has to be some symmetry that has to stay there. And you make use of this general property of the system to deduce things about the individual parts of the system, how they behave. And this is a kind of theory which can be very powerful. But it is much less common than modeling or tool building. And I'm going to be giving you an example today of a very, very simple example of physics-style theory. And we could, later if you want to, we could have a discussion about more examples of this, because there are a lot of examples. It's just that it's not very widely appreciated. Okay, so that's just an aside to warn you something that's coming. So, there's a misprint here, which I didn't see before. It says supposed to say architecture. So what is a scalable architecture? A scalable architecture is what Intel's processors and AMD's processors don't have. Every time Intel wants to make a more powerful computer, they can't just take one design and make it bigger. What they have to do is they just have to redesign the whole damn thing. A scalable architecture is one in which you can make the computer more powerful as you want, simply by making it bigger and bigger and bigger. And this does happen sometimes. So in computer science, there are people who study things like this. So for example, for very special purposes, there are programs that are scalable. One of them that many of you are familiar with is the project for looking for life outside the world, where you have all these radio signals coming and they have computers across the whole network, and you can sign up and if your computer isn't being used for anything else, they will use that for analyzing their data. And so since the number of computers that happen to be available at any time is unknown, they have to have the problem formulated in a way that they can scale it up. The brain has a scalable architecture. This is what we mean when we say, for example, in V1, you have a fovea and you have very good acuity where you're looking. But if you look here and hold up fingers off to the side, you can't even see them. I can't see if I have two or three fingers up over there. That's because we have a bottleneck in our optic nerve, and we can only get so many bits per second through that. And if we did it the way you do a camera, so that and the way some animals do it, so that you had equal resolution every place, then you would have much worse resolution in central vision that you have than we actually do have. So our strategy has been to make extremely good vision centrally, have the quality of vision decrease as you go more peripherally in the retina, and it decreases very slowly as you go out, and it's 10 or 20 times in the periphery, your acuity is 10 or 20 times less than it is in the fovea. And you have, but your visual cortex, and also in your retina, you have more ganglion cells centrally and fewer as you go out. You have more photoreceptors centrally and fewer as you go out. And so basically what you do is you take a small part of the visual world and you spread it over a big part of the cortex, and then you take a big part of the visual world and you assign it to a small part of the cortex. But you have the same cortex there. The receptive fields are the same, the computations are the same. The only thing that's different is how much cortex you're devoting to a particular part of the visual world, and so you can have better acuity. And so this is a scalable architecture, and all vertebrate brains are believed to have a scalable architecture. The fact that we can have different sized visual cortexes, have two or three times more neurons in your visual cortex and all feel as if we have the same vision is a reflection of the scalable architecture. And so I'm going to be talking about the program in my laboratory, which is to find out what the underlying principles, design principles of the brain are that endows it with a scalable architecture. This might even be good for something one day. It's certainly good for brains. Now, I haven't decided yet. We'll see how late things get and how I feel and how you feel. I might talk about two things or one thing. I'm definitely going to talk about one thing. And that has to do with how arbors scale as you make neural circuits bigger. So here is an axon that's coming in and it's to some region and branching. And the thing I'm coloring yellow here is the region over the map in the part of the brain where this arbor comes where it distributes information. This is called, the whole thing is an arbor, because it reminds us of a tree arbor. And the yellow part here is called the arbor's territory. And this is an axonal arbor. And the territory of the arbor is a certain size, and that size says how big a part of the map that's represented there, a map of the body for the somatosensory cortex, a map of the visual world for the visual cortices, and a map of something else for the language cortices. We don't know what the map is. How big a region, a fraction of that map is, does this particular axon spread information? And then there's going to be a dendritic arbor. Here's a cell body. And here are dendrites in a cortical pyramidal cell. And here are basal dendrites. And these also have a territory. And this is the territory of the apical dendrites. And that is, that territory is the volume of the cortical circuitry where this particular cell is sampling information to do its calculations. So the question I'm going to be asking is, if you make a circuit bigger, and if you make the nerve cells in it bigger, how do you change, what principles do you use to change the length of the arbor when you change the size of its territory? The length of the arbor basically says how many synapses you have. That says how much information you're going to be spreading over this area. And the territory is an area if it's a flat arbor, or a volume if it's a volume-filling arbor. The territory is the part of is the region of the map you spread the information. And I'm saying if you want to scale up a circuit, how do you do it in a way that you how do you change the number of synapses that you make as you change the size of the territory? Now the I like fish just fine, but I'm really interested in the human brain. However, it's very difficult to study scalability in the human brain, and so here's our program in the lab. What we do first is we study scalability in the fish brain, which I'll tell you why in a second, and then we define principles that we can identify in the fish brain. And then we go to the mammalian brain, ideally the primate brain, to find out if those same principles hold there. Why fish? The reason fish is that fish, unlike us, continue to grow throughout their lives. Fish never stop growing until they die. And all the time they're growing, their bodies are getting larger and their brains are getting larger. And they're adding more cells to their brain. And these new cells are integrating into the brain, into the circuits. And so by getting fish of different sizes, you can get, it's the same brain, but you can get it in any size you want. Up to, you know, within you don't get a brain as big as ours in a fish, but you get a very wide range of brain sizes. So what we have studied is the retinotectal system, and right here on the left, you can see just right here is a fish brain, and you can't really see it, doesn't matter. The olfactory bulbs are there, the telencephalon is there. About a third of the brain is the optic tectum. That's what the fish uses for processing his visual information. This is the cerebellum here. And this is something here called the vagal lobe, which is a gustatory circuitry for the fish. So as the fish gets bigger and older, then his brain gets bigger, and he's adding cells. Here's an example. This is the brain weight here in milligrams for a bunch of goldfish and also some zebrafish. And we use zebrafish because they are a so-called genetic animal, like all they're animals whose genome you can manipulate. And we use, and they're easy to get, and they're cheap. And we use goldfish because you can go to PetSmart. They keep them and feed them and keep them healthy for you, and you just go and buy them for 19 cents a piece and bring them home. So this is the brain weight, and the way we measure the number of cells in the brain is we extract the total DNA from the brain and divide by the number of DNA per nucleus. And here is the total amount of micrograms of DNA in a bunch of these fish brains. And over here is the number of cells in millions, 10, 100, a billion cells. And you can see that as the brain weight gets bigger, the number of cells increases smoothly along this curve. And this is just the same sort of thing. This is the body weight, and this is the number of cells. And as the fish gets bigger, his brain gets bigger. I could have plotted, you can figure it out from cell number here, cell number there. As the body weight gets bigger, the brain weight gets bigger, and the animal has more and more cells. So just today, we usually work with goldfish maybe this long, and then sometimes that long or that long. And we got some more expensive goldfish today that are about this long. They're really big. Okay, so what we were working on, because it's so well studied in the fish, is the optic tectum and also the retina. The ganglion cells in the retina project back to the tectum, and here is a dye eye, which is a technique for staining individual cells. This is a dye eye filled arbor of a ganglion cell that goes onto the tectum. And this is the actual arbor, and this is 100 microns across there. And this is a reconstruction of the same arbor. We measure the territory of these arbors by what's called the convex hull. We've done it actually several different ways, but the convex hull is easiest. And a convex hull is just this polygon, the convex polygon that connects all the tips of the branches. So inside here is the area of the arbor. For the number of synapses, we measure the length, because the number of synapses is proportional to the total length. So we just measure the length of all these things. When the fish grows, his retina gets bigger, and it grows bigger like this by adding cells around the periphery. The arbors from the cells that were there from when it was a tiny fish are still there on the optic tectum. And as the fish grows, his tectum also grows, but it doesn't grow quite the same way as the retina does. It doesn't grow circumferentially. It grows kind of in a horseshoe. So these parts here grow faster than that part does. So it goes back like that. What this means is, in order to keep the retinotopic map of the world on the tectum, the arbors have to march. And so the arbors that had been there since the fish was a tiny fish are constantly moving across the tectal surface. And not only that, but the arbors are growing larger. The arbors grow larger so that each arbor is a constant proportion of the area of the tectum. So as the fish is scaling up its brain, its arbors are scaling up. And the question we want to ask is, what are the rules that these arbors follow when the brain gets, let's say, when the brain gets bigger, and why does he want to have those rules? Yes.
Are you saying the old ones are getting bigger also?
Yes. The old ones are moving and growing. And the new ones are just coming in and establishing their, and some of the arbors move a little bit and some just move a lot. It depends on where they are on the tectum. Yes?
What's the evidence that synapse number is constant with dendritically?
These are axons, and what we did is we measured the number of you can't maybe see so well here, but if you do confocal images, you can see where the boutons are, and we counted the number of boutons in different sized arbors and found that they're the same. For dendrites, there is for excitatory synapses. There's not a lot of data about this, but the best is a paper by Nigel Unwin, O'Brien, and Unwin. What they found is that dendritic spines make this spiral around the dendrite, and they come in a constant size, a constant spacing, no matter how big the arbor size is. Okay, so what might you expect from these arbors? So here's one possibility. I mean, these are just things that you that you might, if I said, if you thought about it, what you might expect. Here's one possibility. Here comes an arbor. Now these arbors are flat discs. Most of the arbors in the brain fill up a volume, but the retinotectal arbors in fish are like some arbors in our cortex, for example, are flat and they're distributed in various layers. And so the tectal cells have dendrites that go up like this, and they sample arbors from one part of the retina or from another part of the retina in different layers. Plus, they sample things that are being processed by other cells around, and make the arbor and sample all the information in a column that has these arbors in it. Okay, so one possibility is we have a small arbor like this, and then we scale it up. Okay, I didn't draw it very well, but this is supposed to be just magnified. So it might be that what you do is you just take an arbor and you make it bigger by magnifying it. It stays the same, just everything gets longer and farther apart. If this were true, the length of the arbor, L is the total length if you add up all the segments, the total length of the arbor, this little wiggle means is proportional to the area of the arbor, its territory area, to the 1/2 power. If you have a magnifying glass and you just look through it like that, then all the lines are just made longer by the length of every line increases by the square root of the area. So you might expect that to happen. Another thing you might expect is this. Maybe you have your arbor like this. And when you make it bigger, what you do is you have some rule for generating the arbor, and you just follow that rule every place the arbor goes. And so it would be like this, so you wouldn't change it where it was. This is the thing on the left is supposed to be the thing on the right, but then you just keep filling in space according to the same rule. So every place you look in the bigger arbor has the same density of dendritic branches. This would say if you had a patch of the arbor here, you have a rule that generates that patch of the arbor. Every patch is generated the same way. In that case, the length of the arbor would be proportional to the area, because every unit of area has a certain amount of length. You have 10 times as much area, you have 10 times as much length. Okay, so what we did, and we, is Andrea Pillai, and she's back in Singapore now. She's a Singaporean who was a graduate student at UCSD in biology, and I borrowed her from somebody else to work on the project for a while, so she worked on it sort of a summer. And the second one is Joe Snyder. And Andrea did, for example, the DNA extractions. She did put dye crystals on and did reconstructions of things. Joe Snyder is a postdoc whose PhD is in condensed matter physics from Irvine. And Joe has done the computational parts of the project. So, for example, if we want to measure the convex hull of a complicated arbor reconstruction, then he has written programs or adapted programs that will measure the convex hull and measure the length for us. Okay, so these are two things you might expect right off. Maybe the arbor is just magnified, or maybe the same rule is followed every place so it fills up the space the same way. Okay, neither one is right. What actually is true, and these are data from our fish, and some of these are zebrafish and some of these are goldfish. And this is the territory area, because remember I said these are disc-like arbors, and this is area here, and this is the axonal length of the arbor proportional to the number of synapses. and the actual slope of this line drawn through the points here is 3/4. It's halfway between a half and one. Those were the two default theories. And so what's really true for the fish is that the length is proportional to the area of the territory to the 3/4 power. Okay, that's interesting. It's very orderly. That says there's something to study here. That means we need a theory for this. But this is the first part of the project, to identify a rule by looking at fish and then go to mammals. It turns out that there is a rich database on the web of reconstructed axon and dendritic arbors. And we have arbors from mice, cats, and rats. And we have large populations of arbors. And we have arbors from primary visual cortex, from hippocampus, and from somatosensory cortex in these various species. And this graph here is, these arbors are all filling up space. And so you have to have a volume. And by the way, these are log-log plots. This is two orders of magnitude this way, two orders of magnitude this way. This is a log-log plot for all of the arbors that we've ever seen. I can't quite read this, but I think this is
4, 6, 8, 12.
Yeah, it's a lot of orders of magnitude in arbor size along this way, and it's 2, 4, 6 orders of magnitude in this way. This is the length of the arbor. This is the territory volume, and these fellows here, those are axons. And the axons are all down in here. There are maybe 300, 400, 500 arbors in here. For most of these databases, there are also dendrites. And so we measure the volume of the dendritic arbor, and we measure the length. And these squares down here are dendrites. Axons generally have bigger territories than dendrites do. And the reason is that you have to have, on average, the same number of synapses on a dendritic arbor as you do on the axonal arbor. Because if you have an axonal arbor, it has to find a place on dendrites to make its synapses, so they have to balance out that way. For axonal arbors, there is a synapse about every 3 to 4 microns. For dendritic arbors, there are about 10 synapses per micron. So axonal arbors are usually something like 30 times longer, bigger than dendritic arbors, longer. Okay, so it turns out that all arbors in the brain, in the mammalian brain, dendrites and axons follow one scaling law, and the slope of this is not 3/4 like it was over here, but the length of the arbor is proportional to the volume of the arbor to the 1/2 power. That's what this line is right here. This is a remarkable fact, because we didn't select these arbors. These are excitatory arbors, axon dendritic arbors, excitatory, inhibitory, different cortical regions, different cortical layers. Just any arbor you find, you stick it in the computer, you find its convex hull volume, you find its length, and you put a plot on this graph. And what you find is that all the arbors fall on this same line. There are no adjustable parameters here. There's nothing to adjust. It's just the data. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a theory, a physics-style theory, to explain this, tell you why it is. But before I do, let me ask if there are questions about all this. Yeah?
Is that fish on the left and mammals on the right?
Fish on the left, right, and mammals on the right, yeah. And we haven't, we're just now, this project is not one we've been doing very long. And so we collected a bunch of retinotechal arbors. And we're doing another project in the retina itself that I'll tell you about if we feel like it. But so we have not we have not collected dendritic arbors from the fish yet. We're doing that just to go back and see, but I'm pretty sure how it's going to come out. They're not going to be different. There'll be 3D arbors. Most of the arbors are 3D. Yeah.
Are those two the same equation?
Yes, the same equation, just a different power. Well, no, this is the area.
But an area is distance squared.
Yeah.
And volume is distance cubed.
Right.
Then it's distance.
No, but it doesn't work out to the 3/4. So.
Area is distance squared.
Yeah, that's right.
3/2.
They would both be 3/2. That's a way of looking at it, if you look at it that way. Yeah. Okay, so actually what you just said is that if you look across these arbors, that that you have a fractal dimension, and the fractal dimension is 3/2. I'll come back to that. Are there other questions about this stuff before I go on with theory? Okay. Now, the actual theory is a little more complicated than is going to fit in to the time we have, and you don't want to hear it anyway. But I'm going to give you a simplified version of the theory for a special case that shows you what the trick is and gets you the answer, but it makes assumptions that that you don't need to make and aren't usually made. It's just something to illustrate in a special case what is true in the general case. And I'm asking you to, I mean, you can come and see me if you want to, and I'll tell you what the general case is. But I'm just going to do a special case. Let me start by giving you the answer. Okay, here you have an arbor that is spreading information over a region, and that arbor, this is an axonal arbor, and that arbor is being sampled by another arbor, a dendritic arbor. Now what I want to do is, like with the fish, or if I'm looking at different circuits that scale within the brain, what I want to do is I want to make this arbor bigger. That happens in the fish. And we also know, although we haven't studied it ourselves a lot, that the dendritic arbors in the fish also get bigger. And so we have a small arbor being sampled by a small arbor. Now we turn this into a big arbor, and that's being sampled by a big arbor. But in the fish, this is the same circuit. It's doing the same thing. It's true that the fish's computer is a scalable architecture because it not only gets bigger, but it also improves its performance. The eye gets bigger. It's a bigger megapixel eye as the fish grows. And a guy named Steve Easter, who is the leading person. I've never met the guy, but he's a wonderful scientist. He's at Michigan, and he measured quite a while back the visual acuity of fish. Same species of different sizes, and showed that as the fish gets bigger, his visual acuity improves. He's able to see things better. Okay, so I want to have the same circuit. Everything you know means the circuit's basically the same. I want to scale it up bigger. I want the same circuit to be made in the small fish and the big fish. Question: how much longer do I have to make the branches in the big arbor compared to the small arbor here for the axons and the dendrites in order to have the chances that two branches will come close enough together be the same so that you can always make the same circuit? The answer is 3/4 for the flat arbor in the fish and 1/2 for the vertebrate three-dimensional arbors, the main and three-dimensional arbors. So that's the basic idea. The question is, how much longer do you have to make the arbor so the chances of a contact between an axon and a dendrite don't depend on the scale of this thing? That's a principle of a scalable architecture. You want to have the ability to make a circuit be independent of the scale of it. And so I just told you the theory. Now I'm just going to do a little calculation so you can see how it works. Okay, so we're going to have cubic arbors. So here is a cube. And this is the territory of an arbor. It's just a cubic arbor. Okay, here comes a axon into this arbor. And it branches to sort of fill up the space, all of the square space. And I just drew some of the branches in. So this is an axon. And here comes a dendrite from below. And it's going into the same space and filling it up. And this is not true, but it turns out it doesn't matter. It just makes the calculation more convenient. This is the dendrite. I'm going to assume that, just for this calculation, that the density of synapses along an axonal arbor and the density of synapses along a dendritic arbor, I'm going to assume that those densities are the same. So the length of the axon and the length of the dendrite are the same. That's not true in general, but it turns out it doesn't really affect the calculation. You get the right answer when you do it this way, and as you change the relative densities of synapses, you get the same answer. Okay, so then I take a little cube of this arbor up here, and I make that cube, and the arbor volume, the total arbor volume is V. Little V is the cube of volume. And I pick the volume of this little cubelet, and I'm filling up the space with these little cubelets. I pick the volume of that such that it's about 1 or 2 cubic microns. Why do I pick that? Because if an axon and a dendrite are in the same cube, they're close enough that the spine could reach out and grab the axon. And so you could have a synapse between them if they're in the same cube. If they're in different cubes, they're too far away. Then the total number of cubes is equal to the total volume divided by the volume of each little cube. The volume of the territory is the volume of the big square, big cube. That's capital V. That's the territory volume. And if you think about it, or if you know about the right things, you'll know that if you have really small cubes, that the length of the arbor is equal to n times V to the 1/3, and n is the number of occupied. The number of occupied cubes. If you have a cube here, if the length of the axon and the dendrite are the same, so the number of cubes that they both occupy, little cubes that they both occupy, is going to be the same, and the length is proportional to the number of cubes that happen to be occupied. And the proportionality constant is the length of one side of a cube. Okay, what's the probability that if you look at random in a cube, you'll find an axonal arbor? The probability of an axonal arbor being in any one little cube is the number that are occupied divided by the total number of cubes that there are. And that is also true for the dendritic arbor, because the way I set this problem up, the territories are the same and the number of little cubes is the same that are occupied because the arbors are the same length. What's the probability that an arbor is in, that an axon and a dendrite are in the same cube. Well, these things are so sparse that it's, that, that they aren't influencing one another, and so capital P is the probability of joint occupancy. Which equals n over capital N squared. The product of it's like if you flip two coins, what's the product? What's the probability of two heads? Is the probability of the head times the probability of another head? It's the probability squared. Okay, now this is the probability of having joint occupancy. What's the average number of cubes that are going to be occupied? The average number is going to be capital N times P. What's the average number of heads you're going to get if you flip 100 coins? It's going to be N times P, 50. So N is the number of little cubes. P is the probability that they're doubly occupied. And that is the average number of doubly occupied things. That's the average number of chances that you have to make a synapse between these two arbors. And we want that to be independent of the size of the arbor. We want it to be proportional to one. It's equal to some constant. We don't know what it is. And this equals n times little n over capital N squared, which equals little n squared over capital N proportional to one. That says that little n is proportional to capital N to the 1/2 power. And if you look back up here, it says that the length of the that little n is proportional to the length of the arbor, and capital N is proportional to the volume to the 1/2 power. So this is exactly what we found in the experiment on the left there. The length of a 3D arbor that's interacting with a 3D arbor, they ought to increase by the square root. now, if you have a 2D arbor like this interacting with a 3D arbor, and you just do out a little bit of algebra, what you'll find is that the length of that needs to be proportional to the area to the 3/4 power. And you can do that out yourself. It's not hard to do. Basically, the length of the arbor is the number of cubes in one layer, which is going to be the volume to the total number of the volume to the 2/3 power, and that's where the 3/4 comes from. Okay, so I'm just recapitulating what the program is. The program is you go to Fish, you find a rule that happens in a scalable brain where you can study it. You go and you check, does some version of that rule happen in a mammalian brain? We found a very interesting rule. We found that all arbors, axons and dendrites of every kind, with all shapes, conform to a single principle, architectural principle, and that is that the length is related to the volume in a particular way, which is what I said. Then you say, why would you want to have it that way? And I claim that you have to have it that way to have a scalable architecture, because a scalable architecture is one where you make it bigger, but you keep the basic circuit diagram the same. And so you have to make them longer that way in order to be able to make the same circuit and everything. And so this is a principle that you would need to have a scalable architecture for the brain.
I'm puzzled because the circuit can't very well be the same if you think about it in this simple-minded way, that the axon is going to carry the signal that represents the calculation by the dendrite.
Yeah.
So if you've got new dendritic arbors, and that means you've got additional synapses,
Sure.
Which means things are going to happen in a different sort of way. So a different message has to come out of the axon.
This axon
can't actually be the same.
But this axon is going in.
And here's
an arbor sampling that axon.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is that the arbors down here that are sampling the axon have to be able to make the same circuit. They may not actually make the same circuit, but they have to be able to. So, for example,
they possibly can, because if the signal has to come, eventually what you want is the signal to come back to the dendrite, back through the dendrites and
cell body and go to some other place.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you're getting new contacts in addition to the old ones, how can the new ones not give you a different result?
We're getting into what the second part of the talk would be. But the basic idea is, suppose that you don't make the arbors longer in this way. Then, as they get bigger and bigger, this cell here will never be able to find that cell. Because the chances that they'll be able to get close enough is less and less and less and less.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you made them branch too much, then you'd be using up all your space. And so you've got to have, in order to be able to make the same circuit, you've got to be able to do that.
Okay,
so now a lot of people in the room don't care, but most people at this point would say, so this is a physics style theory. It's not a model. It's just saying what properties does a system have to have in order to do what you think its job is. And this doesn't say what the genes are that does it. This doesn't say what the signaling networks are of the genetic networks that cause the arbors to be made this way. This is not a model for how the arbors work. So this is not the normal kind of theory, but it's a kind of theory that can be very powerful, and it tells you the sort of thing that you would never know otherwise. You wouldn't even know you had this problem. I submit that you could know every gene involved in making arbors. You could know every genetic network that was doing it. You could make a model that made things look like they were perfectly good arbors, but you still wouldn't know this principle. You might run across it by chance, but what this does is this tells the people who study arbors that they have something to explain they never knew they had to explain. And it's just a different level of explanation than the genetic level or the mechanistic level. So I can tell you that we have also done modeling where you make a computer model, and I can tell you that you can make a lot of good-looking arbors. They look like an arbor, like a perfectly plausible arbor with some sort of rules for generating it that don't follow this rule. And the way you do make an arbor that follows this rule, a model arbor, is that it's the way real arbors are made. There's a branch here. It sticks out a trial branch. If it makes a synapse, then it gets stabilized and it grows. If it doesn't make synapses out here, one or more, then it gets retracted. And if you have arbors that are competing for the same synaptic pool, then they do a sort of self-avoiding random walk, because this guy here is taking up the potential targets that this guy could have, and so he can't get too near there. He has to stay away from other ones. Anyway, that sort of model will generate arbors that have these same scaling laws. Okay, so I was going to talk about fractals. Maybe I won't, because nobody here cares about fractals. So there may be five people, but nobody else does. So I'm not going to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop. We'll take a break, and then if people want to hear another version of scalability, this time having to do with the retina, I'll give that talk after we rest a minute.
Great.
Okay. Good. Okay. Okay, so as the fish grows, his retina gets bigger. The retina has a sensory surface with a bunch of photoreceptors, and then there are a bunch of retinal ganglion cells, about 24 different types, that are on that surface. And the question I'm going to be asking is, how big do you want the arbors of the retinal ganglion cells to be as the fish arbor grows, as the fish's brain grows? So I'm going to do it first for fish, and then I'm going to go to mammals, just like last time. Okay, so here is the visual world. There's a lake, some mountains, the sun, and we have a small fish that's looking at this, and we have a big fish that's looking at this. They're both imaging the same visual world under their retinas, and each one of these, and the thing that is sampling this visual information that's been transduced by the photoreceptors and processed by some intermediate layers, are the retinal ganglion cells. And here is the retinal ganglion cell of a particular cell in the small fish. The question is, how big is that in the big fish? It may be bigger, it may be the same size, it may be smaller, who knows? We'd like to know why you would want to, how big you'd want to make these retinal ganglion cells, how big you want to make them, and why you'd want to make them that size. And so that's what the talk is about. There are, if you think about cameras, there are two things that you would care about for the retina. One of them is the resolution. So A is the retinal area, and little a is the retinal ganglion cell dendritic arbor area. So, and actually, each one of the cell types has a different sized area. And so you look at the average of a bunch of these. Now, you can think about this sort of as an analog of a digital camera, where A is the pixel size, and capital A is the size of the array, of the photo detector array. What would you want? Well, the more pixels you have, the more megapixel your camera is, the better its resolution. And so you could say that the resolution, R equals resolution, is going to be equal to, defined to be equal, proportional, doesn't matter, to the area of the retina divided by the area of each receptive field, each retinal ganglion cell arbor. That is, so if you make A, little a, smaller compared to the retinal size, you'll have more megapixels and you'll have a better resolution. Now, the other thing is, though, that why not make the arbors all tiny? Well, the reason is that each arbor is collecting information from a part of the world, and it has a certain number of synapses that's related to the size of the arbor. And how reliable that information is, how reliable it knows the intensity of the world, is related to the size. And so you can have something called accuracy, called alpha equals accuracy. And that is just proportional to the area of the arbor. The bigger the arbor is, the more bits of information it's getting. This is proportional to the amount of information the arbor is getting. So the accuracy is going to be proportional to the information, and the resolution is defined as being kind of how many pixels you can have. There are three cases you can think about. maybe what we really care the most about is resolution. And so what we would do is we would keep the accuracy constant. So that says that A equals alpha, or proportional to, is proportional to 1. That would say we keep our pixel size the same and we make our array bigger. This is what they do in a lot of the digital cameras. And that says that the resolution increases in proportion to the area of the photoreceptor array. So if you really wanted to have the very best vision you could possibly have, what you do is you keep your photoreceptors, your retinal ganglion cell arbors, all the same size, and just have more and more of them. As you have more and more with the same world focused on them, then your resolution would just increase in proportion to the area. That's a perfectly reasonable thing. And you might expect that to be true. A second case is the following. Maybe you live in a world where your resolution is actually pretty good already. You don't need it better. What you really want is to have the most accuracy, the best sensitivity. So people, experimentalists, frequently do this. If you're using low light levels in a CCD camera and you buy a new camera that has a bigger array and more pixels, what you do is you average together the signal from, say, four of the little pixels into an analysis pixel so that you have better sensitivity, better accuracy. So you might say you keep the resolution of the thing constant. And in that case, what would happen would be that the accuracy is proportional to A. And I'm getting that from these original definitions up here. That's the second case where you would decide my resolution is fine the way it is. I really care about getting the best accuracy of light. There's a third case, a third limiting case, and that is you might say, you know what, I don't want to put all my eggs in the retina, in the accuracy basket, or all my eggs in the resolution basket. What I want to do is, as my retina gets bigger, I want to keep some evolutionarily selected ratio of those two things constant. I want to have the ratio of the resolution to the accuracy proportional to 1. That would say that as you increase the size of the retina, you would decrease the size of the pixel relative to the world, but you would also increase the area of the pixel so it got more accuracy, so everything would get better. And evolution would have selected a particular value of that ratio that the animal needs for what he does in life. Because what this says is, if you just do the algebra from up above, this says that the accuracy is proportional to the resolution, is proportional to the square root of the area. So accuracy is proportional to the square root of the area, and resolution is proportional to the square root of the area. And so as the area increases, both increase and the ratio stays constant, because if you divide one of those by the others, the square roots of area drop out. So the question is, which of these things do actual retinas do? Because you can't know a priori. They're all quite reasonable, and there might be different parts of the brain that use different ones of these arguments. Because I'll take this from the retina to the vertebrate, the mammalian brain in a few minutes. So then you just have to do the experiment to see what it does. Then you'll know. Sunhua Li is the person who has done these experiments, and she's done a beautiful job. And I actually, I didn't change the slides because I've been a little bit busy with something else, so I have not included her latest data in here now. But there are another 30 or something like that retinal ganglion cell arbors. So what Sunhua has been doing is you dissect out the eye of a fish. We have a wide range of fish sizes. We tend to the small ones because she's scared of the big ones. She'll do it when she has to. So then you have a bunch of different size retinas. You measure the area of the retina, and you put a tiny dye eye crystal into the optic nerve, and you let the dye eye diffuse back, and you stain cells. Then she puts them in the confocal and takes a stack of images, and then using NeuroLucida reconstructs the arbors. And I'm not going to show you what the arbors look like. I'll just show you what the results are. This is the retinal area, and this is the retinal ganglion cell dendritic arbor in area. This is the pixel size. And you can see the data fall. These are average data. They're average over fish of the same size because there are a wide range of arbor sizes in any one retina because there are two dozen different kinds of ganglion cells. Some have big arbors, some have small. So you have to average across arbors of fish the same size. And so there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 points here where we had nine classes of fish sizes that were close enough to average, and there are about 60 arbors total in here. And the slope of this line drawn on there is 1/2. Here is the retinal area and the resolution. Remember, resolution is defined as the total retinal area divided by the pixel size. The pixel size is predicted to increase, is predicted to increase like the square root of the area. The resolution is predicted to increase like the square root of area. And from Sunhua's data, you can see that this is resolution, retinal area. There are the data points, and there's a line drawn with a slope of 1/2. So the answer is that what the brain does is it picks alternative number 3. What it does is it doesn't put all of its eggs in the resolution basket. It doesn't put all of its eggs in the accuracy basket. It divides it up equally, so there's always, as the fish grows, a fixed determined ratio of those two quantities. I speculate that is evolutionarily determined by the fish, that he needs to have some balance of those things. And he doesn't want, as he grows bigger and bigger and bigger, to have either resolution take over or accuracy take over. He wants to keep them balanced.
We have questions?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Have you been able to rule out other factors like how the optics might change as the fish gets larger? For example, the pupil gets bigger, you're going to get better sensitivity for free, and you get more light. Or if it's like humans, the lens will get poorer quality as the
fish have. This is something else Sunhua has been doing, and that is that she has been making macro sections through the eyes. So we can see the lens, we can see the size of the pupil, we can see how big the retina is, and the lens does get bigger. But I don't think its optics get better. I think it stays. It's a spherical lens. They have the fish eyes have a fish eye lens. It's the name fish eye lens. I think they're spherical, and they get bigger and bigger. But I think that I don't think the quality of the optics changes. And the size of the pupil gets bigger, but the size of the pupil always gets bigger in a fixed proportion to the size of the retina. So the same amount of light is getting spread over the retina. Yes?
Do you think that the accuracy could have different meanings in visual system? What meaning do you think is most important here?
Well, I took it to be just the total quantity of information, assuming that every synapse that gives independent information, and that you are increasing in proportion to the number of synapses that you would just be increasing the amount of information because it's additive. I mean, it's a simple little thing. You can make other definitions, and that would change things. But these are just the simplest four of them. Yeah. Okay. Now, Andrea and Joe and I have also been looking at the tectum. The tectum has a map. There are dendritic trees in the map, and they're going to have pixels that are going to be sampling the visual map. And you might say, how does the pixel size as defined by the size of the dendritic tree, how does that change as the size of the map grows? From experiment, we know that n is equal to the number of neurons in the tectum is proportional to the area of the tectum, just straight ahead. Now, there's some other stuff that we have not measured the dendritic tree sizes yet in fish. We're going to be doing that. But if we assume that the dendritic trees in fish, which are volume filling, follow the same rule as all of those arbors I was just telling you about, then what we can do is I'm not going to go through the algebra for it, just to take my word for it. We can say that the number of synapses that a cell has ends up being proportional to the area of the pixel defined by how big a part on the surface of the map a particular cell is sampling information. And this is basically an experimental fact. Okay, so we know that the number of synapses times the total number of cells times times the number of synapses per cell is the total number of synapses in the tectum. S is the total number of synapses, and we know that the pixel area, what I showed you before, the pixel area for case 3 is proportional to the square root of the area, which is proportional to the square root of n, which is proportional to the number of synapses per cell. And so the total number of synapses in the tectum is proportional to n times the square root of n, which is n to the 3/2 power. And these ought to be proportionalities here. We know from experiment that the density of synapses is independent of the size of the brain. And so that means that the volume, this is proportional to the volume of the tectum. And so this says that the volume of the tectum is proportional to the number of neurons in the tectum to the 3/2 power, or the number of neurons is proportional to the volume to the 2/3 power. So this is a prediction based on the combination of, and I left out a step, because I didn't want to take time to do it because I want to get through. But this is based on a prediction based on the idea that the 3D arbors scale the way I just said they did, plus experiments that Andrea and Joe and I have done, measuring the areas of our areas of the tectum, the number of cells in tectum, and things like that. This is the volume of the tectum in cubic millimeters, microliters, and this is the number of neurons in the tectum as we measured from reconstructions. These are the data points, and the reason you see things that are close together, that's a left and a right tectum in the same fish. And so there they are. And this line has a slope of 2/3. So what this says is basically that if you go from the retina to the brain, you follow exactly the same principle that you follow for the retina, that you take, that you balance the accuracy in terms of number of synapses per cell. You balance the accuracy with the resolving power of this map. In this case, it's the map of the visual world. And so as you increase, you keep them both going like the square root. Okay, this is fish. What about mammals? There's not much in the literature, but this is the parvo and magnocellular nucleus of a bunch of primate LGNs. These are hominoid LGNs, thalamus, and these are all of the thalamic nuclei. This is the dorsal and the ventral claustrum, and this is a bunch of brainstem nuclei, 5 brainstem nuclei. So locus coeruleus is that one. I can't remember what the other ones are. In every case, the volume is plotted versus the number of cells in that structure, and in every case, the line drawn on here is a line with a slope of 2/3. So what this says is that it is a general principle that evolution has, every time there's a map, when it makes the map bigger, like it does in the case of the LGN, I have no idea what the map in the claustrum is, but there's probably some map there. Everyone thinks there is because it's an orderly mapping of other parts of the brain to it. And there's certainly orderly mappings between all of the thalamic nuclei in the cortex. So every time you have a map, what you do is evolution has selected some balance between accuracy and resolution, and it keeps that fixed as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's why, and these are all the data that I'm aware of. I didn't leave anything out. I don't know any others. I'd love to see them. Actually, there are people in the lab who are now looking at, like, for example, Nakush. Carlo is looking at the size of the amygdala, the subnuclei in the amygdala, in a bunch of different size monkeys. And so we'll have data later that we can put an amygdala on here too. So anyway, the idea is that this is a general principle that when you scale up something, a general scaling principle, when you scale it up, what you do is you make a balance between area and, between its pixel size and accuracy, so that you keep the constant resolution and the accuracy constant. This is not true for the cortex. The cortex uses scheme. The cortex uses scheme one. It doesn't make the pixel size bigger. It just makes more pixels. And so we have a different rule for cortex and all the other parts of the brain. And it may be that it's a part of the brain that puts all its eggs in case two, I said it wrong. This is cortex. This is everything else. And maybe there's some place where you put all your eggs in the resolution basket. Maybe there's some case where you don't care about accuracy, whatever minimal accuracy is okay, you just go ahead. Okay, so what I think this has shown again is that you can start with a brain where it's easy to study scalability. You measure the stuff that you need to study there. You can learn rules that are followed when it scales. You can make theories for why they scale. This is a class of theories because it's three possibilities of what might happen. And then you can find out what's right for the fish. And then you can go to the mammalian system and find out if the same thing works. And so there are other things that we're doing where this also works the same way. Okay, thank you.
Further
yes.
questions?
Yes.
We've got a few minutes.
Yeah. Okay, so I was going to listen to the end because it's sort of a diversion. But you're talking about how the spatial resolution, visual spatial resolution in the fovea is much higher than the peripheral vision. But just phenomenologically, I seem to experience a far higher temporal resolution in my peripheral vision. I don't know if there's anything you can add to that, in terms of explanatory.
Yeah, so I think the reason for that is that the part of your brain that is looking at motion is MT, and if you have the same motion here and the same motion there, then what you're doing is the velocity that the brain sees in terms of receptive fields crossed per second is see if I'm getting this right. Anyway, if you think about the way MT works, that's the way it should be, because you have one neuron here, a pair of neurons here, or a certain part of the cortex here, represents a bigger part of the visual world, and so you interpret things, or you can see motion better for the periphery than you can the central vision.
And just to, if anyone wants to experience this, the way that I've discovered this actually in myself is, if you have a CRT, like monitor or television,
and you turn your head right.
Face 90 degrees from it and see it off to the side, you can see the flicker.
Right, your flicker fusion is different, right, yeah.
You can't see it, I can't see it, but I look straight at it.
Yeah, I've noticed the same thing.
Yeah, it's odd.
Yeah, it's quite a striking thing, because sometimes you, actually, in my house, when I'm sitting, having breakfast, reading the paper, there is a little strip of window that is off to the side, and I'm reading here, and anytime anything moves out there, boy, I immediately see it because it attracts my attention, because it's just a tiny little window because of that effect, yeah. Yeah.
Now you say you find two different laws of the brain, and the cortex and other parts of the brain. Can you unify those two in terms of some sort of information theory?
I think I understand why the cortex is what it is, but I don't know enough about what these subcortical regions do to be able to make a speculation about why they would not want to do it this way. Basically, the cortex is modular, and you get your scalable architecture there by doing the same computation in every little module. And so if you want more power, what you do is you just make it bigger and then spread the same input information, the same world across this bigger surface, and then you calculate more times. So that's why you follow the rule that you do for the cortex. But why the retina does this, basically the cortex is just figured out that it can do its calculations with sufficient accuracy with a little patch. That you just multiply the patches, but that's not true for the other structures. But exactly why, I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Did you include the hippocampus as one of the cortical structures that has this property, or is it a little different?
I um, I don't know that there. I don't believe they're not. See, in order to find this out, if it's true, what you have to have is you have to have data across a bunch of comparable brains that are a range of sizes, and there are data in hippocampus for rat, for example, and maybe primates for how many cells there are and what the volume is. But nobody has systematically studied. You know, what you'd want to do is you'd want to use a mouse and a rat and a capybara and something like that and have a big wide range of brain sizes. And I just don't know of any data.
And the cerebellum maybe is, that's a similar difficulty. So I mean, it'd be interesting to know whether it was like cortex or like the subcortex.
Yes, so the cerebellum is, I know something about the scaling laws there. And we're going to study it in fish because we can.
Yeah.
But the only scaling law I know for cerebellum is that the most cells in the brain are the granule cells in the cerebellum.
Right.
That's the vast majority. The number of Purkinje cells, the number of cells of granule cells, is proportional. The number of Purkinje cells is proportional to the number of granule cells to the 2/3 power. And this goes from mice to man over this giant range. But exactly, I haven't thought, I know it is, I ran across this, but I don't know exactly, I haven't thought about exactly why it's that way.
Interesting. The difference between the two sets of structures is very puzzling. So, I mean, has anybody ever looked in invertebrates? I mean, if you've got a little leech and the leech gets bigger and so forth, is there anything? Does anybody know anything?
I don't think anybody has done it. Some of these rules probably will be the same. Some won't, because the invertebrate brain design is so different.
It is.
Because in general, an invertebrate only has one cell. What a mammal has many cells for. And so they may get bigger as the brain gets bigger. So, the arbors may get bigger, but you don't get more cells because our strategy is to make every copy as fault tolerant as possible and make more copies, and make fewer copies. And their strategy is to make every copy pretty good, but make a lot of them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At least a few will get through.
Right.
And so we go to great lengths to get fault tolerance, and you do that by having redundancy, many cells doing the same thing. And that way you can take out any one cell and the thing doesn't go down, the computer doesn't go down. But but you take a cell out and invertebrates are made so they can walk on three legs instead of four,
right,
and stuff like that, or five instead of six and so forth. But take out one or two cells and one leg is gone.
Another question from the back.
Some of your resolution arguments sounded like they might depend on the idea that, I think you were saying that to preserve resolution, you couldn't increase the size of your arbor too much, or relative to the size of the retina. And I guess that comes from the idea that if you look at an individual cell, the larger the receptive field or arbor, the more uncertain it is about the position of something. But
that's correct.
Isn't the hyperacuity, the case of hyperacuity in human vision, kind of a counterexample in that, and it goes along with kind of a coarse coding system where if you have larger receptive fields, you can do more averaging, and that can actually benefit acuity.
Yeah. So if you look at in the retina, if you look at receptive field size, and you look at the spacing between receptive fields, that is fixed no matter how big the receptive field is and they're always around three receptive field widths apart. And that's because as you go to bigger and bigger arbors, and you have noise, it's harder to make discriminations because you're looking across such a wide range. And if you have smaller and smaller arbors, then the arbor doesn't cover the sensory surface well enough so that the resolution isn't very good. And so there's an optimal arbor size, an optimal receptive field size for retina that has the best resolution in the face of noise and stuff like that. And that's right around where they are. So I think you could make the arbors bigger and bigger and bigger, but it gets harder and harder to have resolution because every arbor is so flat and it's hard to tell if it's here or there. And if you're looking across so many of them, you would have the spread of things exceed the feature you're trying to see in the environment.
Okay. Oh, the gong is going for a while.
Okay, thank you.
Chuck, thank you so much. This was really good.